Welcome to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP, the federal leader in retirement planning seminars. Join NITP this morning for an hour of plain talk on planning your future. You've got questions, they've got answers.
Welcome to For Your Benefit, brought to you by NITP. And we're going to talk about insurance. What should you know? What do you need to know? And to lead us in that discussion is John Gillick, certified financial planner, fellow seminar presenter, and good guy. Good morning, John.
Good morning, Bob.
It's been a few weeks, and John Elliott, retired Fed, retired seminar presenter, but still answers the emails. How are you this morning?
Just tired.
Just tired?
Yeah.
Okay, but John is going to keep us alert. Okay. Is there a good insurance timeline? I wrote these, or maybe you wrote these. Is there a good insurance timeline for federal employees to consider? And we shouldn't say insurance. Let's do the easy one first. Of course, they're going to buy health insurance, and of course, that's going to come from the Fed. So we can take that off the table, I suppose.
Right.
The next one, liability umbrella, maybe we'll skip that. And how about this, life insurance? Some people say it's never too early to buy it. Others say wait midway through. I don't know. What would your educated response to that be?
Well, it's a tough question because life insurance is, as I like to term it, death insurance is exactly that. When I review, I work with life insurance quite a bit. When I review insurance coverage for folks, there's always too much or there's not enough. And I'd say it's an industry that's plagued with folks are presented life insurance as an option. And very, very rarely do I hear folks have been through some type of a needs analysis to determine, how much coverage they actually, should have in force. And that coverage could be, significant. If you're younger, you have children. As you purchase homes, your financial condition changes, you continue to add on that life insurance. But then later in life, you're at a place, hopefully, financially secure where you should be able to start to eliminate that coverage. And so from the very beginning, I find the younger folks are grossly underinsured. The ones that are out there having children, they've got the house payments. And then on the other end of the spectrum, the kids are gone. It's mom and dad at home in a house probably significantly larger than they need. And with a lot of federal service folks, those homes are paid for. And when I'm reviewing with folks like that, the question is, why are you still carrying all this death insurance? And the common response is, well, hey, that's a great question. And then the next question I'll have for them is, oh, by the way, do you have your long-term care? And usually the answer to that is no.
Right. That was my experience, anecdotal experience as well. But people would ask about dropping life insurance that had multiples of Part B, which we can discuss if you want. But I'd say, yeah, and I'd throw some questions at them to make sure they didn't still have responsibilities that they needed, multiples of Part B. But a lot of people, then when we went through it, said, well, I'm just going to drop all my Part B and keep the basic.
Yeah, I think we have a question here, why have I heard Figley will become more expensive in retirement? I think you could speak to that.
Yeah, I actually got out of Figley as a Fed at about age 50. I had both my wife and I had all five multiples of Part B. So with a basic, we each had about six times our salary if one of us died. And I saw the price goes up on Part B at 50 and fairly dramatically. And I looked at that and I then went to my insurance agent where I had some small policies and a major insurance company. And then I said, can you beat this price? And he said, yes. And he did. And I saved over the years a lot of money by getting out of Figley and moving to private insurance, so to speak. Now, I had to take a physical, but it was, they came to my house. It wasn't very much. It was your basic signs, took my blood pressure, whatever, that type of thing.
And you did this at 50?
Yeah.
Okay, so this is not pre-retirement.
Yeah,
it was really, late mid-career.
Yeah, it was.
Good point.
And, yeah, it was one of the better decisions I made. Never had any regrets. It's you should take a look at it.
If you look at one's beginning career, beginning, maybe there isn't any grand need for it. No significant other, no spouse, no kids, just out of school. Got to scratch your head, I would guess.
Right.
But then I think, at least my experience in talking with clients and as an accountant, they'll come in and I'll say, yeah, I have $100,000. Now, $100,000 is a lot of money. There's no question. But it's nothing for somebody young that would have to carry somebody for a long period of time should
That's
they
correct,
pass.
Yeah.
With all due respect to 100, it just isn't much. And especially maybe as they go further, then they have obligations, whether they're married or not. And then they become married, then they got another obligation. It's not an obligation, it's a fairness. And, you know, how much will X dollars insurance pay per month to carry that person along with the lack of income from the spouse? And I don't know the answer to that because I guess you got to do it backwards. And, you know, what do you spend? You know, what are your fixed
right.
expenses
yeah, your
and
expenses?
Beyond that? And then you have to fund it with X dollars, but X dollars has got to pay a certain amount each year rather than buying an annuity in a low interest rate environment. I'm getting off subject here. I'm sorry about that.
That's all right.
So when you talk to people and they have this concept, I'm not saying everybody's got this, but they have this concept that X dollars is a lot of money. How do you bring them down and say it is, but it isn't in future?
In future dollars?
Yeah.
It's an interesting conversation. It's easier with the folks that are younger that are, as I would say, cranking out the kids and mm-hmm. Building up the debt. And, you know, the conversation there is fairly simple. And it's interesting when I usually joke about it in class, but, you know, I have a lot of young, the husbands coming in and they've got themselves insured. And typically I'll hear about a, 20-year, million-dollar policy, and there's some pride behind the fact that they've got this insurance in force. And there's two kids involved, and I just quickly look at the wife, and I said, so how much insurance does he have on you? And usually the answer is maybe $100,000 or $50,000, and it's just a low amount. And I said, okay, I look back to the husband and say, okay, let me break this down. I'm guessing that she does the majority of the care for the children, whether you're around or not. And if something were to happen to your wife, just think about the expense of it. You know, $100,000 isn't going to cover you through the first, 4 or 5 years of having to, potentially bring in someone like an au pair, daycare. I mean, daycare, I'm hearing prices from folks that luckily mine were taken care of by grandma next door. So whenever we were out to eat with them, I'd pay the tab, because there was no charge. But you start
nice
to
policy.
$500 a week for two children is pretty typical now, and that's just during the day. That's
with very little tax benefit.
Yeah, and then we get into college expense, weddings, vehicles, insurance, and. You know, if you have two breadwinners, one of them passes away, so it's pretty easy to stack up the need. And usually when I'm out teaching, I'll have a room typically with federal service where the folks are older. And so I get talking about life insurance and these needs, and I say, hey, how many of you have grandchildren? And, of course, you get quite a few hands up. And I'd say these are the questions you need to take back to your children, your son, daughter, son-in-law, daughter-in-law, to say, hey, if something happens to you, do you have your bases covered? But we get over into the will side. It's not much of a departure from insurance, but those are the things that I find are chronic in class when you're teaching, is that if you say, how many of you have a will? How many of you have those documentation if you pass away? How many of you have the advance directive? How many of you have a power of attorney in case you become incapacitated? Less than 25% in pretty much every room I've ever taught when I asked that question. And when you ask the life insurance question, I mean, how many of you have grandchildren that are underinsured or just flat out not insured at all? And same thing, you kind of get this look of uncertainty. But life insurance is crucial, but it's there for you to die. So again, people are grossly overinsured, grossly underinsured. I very rarely ever find them on target. And part of the materials that I use is a life insurance needs calculator, which is about a 2-3 page worksheet where you add up all the need, things like, replacement income, college, things that are important to you. Cost to bury you. I mean, it is, been to enough funerals here. Maybe it's a rash that's going on, but, $25,000 is not out of the question for a funeral.
Yeah, a lot of people will, as I said earlier, they'll drop their Part B after discussing it usually, or they'll figure it out themselves. In any case, but they keep the basic, and they view, and a number of people view that as burial insurance. They'll take the maximum reduction, which is 75% reduction, which is the cheapest of the three options. You can go 50% or no reduction. Obviously, 75% reduction is going to be cheapest. And so they'll elect that. And at 65, or retirement if after 65, it starts reducing each month until in about 3 years it reaches 25% of its original value. But since your basic is paid to your salary when you walk out the door, retire, so if your salary was, say, $100,000, you're left with $25,000, and it's free once it starts reducing. Not while it's free at 65, just no more premium. So they look at that $25,000 or $30,000, whatever it is, as burial insurance. Mm-hmm. Not everybody, but that was the feedback I got from a lot of people.
Yeah,
that's not a bad idea. Mm-hmm. I didn't keep the basic, but maybe if I'd thought about it, maybe I would have. But because even the insurance I bought to replace the basic as well was cheaper at the time.
Right.
John, you mentioned something about there's a calculator that you look at on a needs basis to see what you need. Because mentally, I'm going to be your client. And I said, well, I have $100,000. I have $200,000. And if I need $25,000 more a year to help make the ends meet, that'll last a long time. But a needs analysis, I would imagine, would take into consideration inflation, future costs, and whatnot. So it isn't just dividing a number into a number and say, that's what I need. It does your silly question. Does your calculator do that? But
actually, and it's interesting you brought up the inflation. The answer is no. And the needs analysis, or most of them that I run into, don't put the inflation factor in. And it's interesting when you talk about life insurance and you look at inflation, that really, when you get into these permanent policies, I see there's a question here about the types of policies. You have your group, which would be the Figley in the Federal Service. You have term insurance, which is basically you're renting the coverage. And folks go, well, geez, I pay all that money in, and I get to the end of the term, and I don't get anything back. And I said, well, you do. You're still alive. That's what your benefit is there.
Well, it's like with your auto insurance, you hope you don't have an accident just so it makes it worth it to have all those years of auto insurance.
Right. Well, and John's going on vacation this week, and I'm sure you'll rent a car. And
no.
but if he was renting a car on vacation, the expectation is not to turn it back into one of the rental car companies and get cash back. So the life insurance, the most effective way to purchase life insurance is through term insurance. It's going to be the least expensive route for folks to buy insurance coverage. When you get into whole life, universal life, variable universal life, you now have policies that you pay in, and over time, if it's done correctly, they can build cash value, fairly large amounts of cash. But those policies are more typical nowadays for estate planning cases, where you're setting up a life insurance trust. You're trying to get liquidity outside of the estate to pay estate taxes. But again, when I review folks, review life insurance for folks, I see a lot of these policies that, you know, whole life policies that, you know, a 20-year-old has, or, I mean, in their mid-20s. And it's hard for me to swallow that pill because it's one of these things where it's not the right product. It's not the right fit.
Is it ever the right product in the timeline, your lifeline? Whole life, universal life. Is there any use for it, say, later on in life?
Estate planning.
Huge
for estate planning. And it's interesting because when you look at inflation, the one problem I have with life insurance over a very long distance is, as I use an example in class, I said, if I have a 25-year-old that says, I want $1 million policy and I want it to last forever, well, that would be whole life. It would be extremely expensive. And it would build cash value. Most likely it would endow the way with whole life. It would be worth $1 million at age 100. But the problem is when the 25-year-old, because prices double every 24 years, I say, okay, let's just round it up to 25. When the 25-year-old is 50, that $1 million will only spend like $500,000 in today's dollars. When the 25-year-old is 50, then 75, the $1 million payout is equivalent to $250,000 in today's dollars.
Yeah.
If they make it to 100, whether they make it, you know, it pays $1 million out or they have $1 million in cash valuing the policy at 100, it's $125,000 in today's dollars.
Do you ever get somebody younger, if you will, that buys the right policy that would cover X dollars, but it's a term policy? 10-year, 20-year. At the end of the term, do they get sticker shock with what it would take to get another term policy or a whole life policy, whole life being a lot more in premium, but it builds up a cash value?
I think they get the sticker shock, but they also realize that they're buying the insurance for the period of the need. So when we talk about an insurance timeline, if you have a 30-year mortgage, you just got into a house, there's two of you paying the mortgage, one of you passes, you'd like to be able to pay that house off in full. Now, from a tax standpoint, that may or may not be a good idea, but the insurance should be bought for the period of the need. And because once you get past that 24-year mark, prices double, the coverage that you purchased 24 years prior only has half the spending power. So it's that erosion of the face amount. So the face amount of the policy for insurance is fixed over time. The inflation is going to eat away at the purchasing power. So I'm not a fan of anything, you know, for ordinary life insurance. I shouldn't say ordinary because it's a whole different type of life. For the basic use of life insurance, I'm with term insurance all the way. It's the least expensive, most cost-effective. If you want to have cash value, cash building, then, you know, get the term insurance and get a Roth IRA. There's other ways that are more cost-effective to, you know, to build your wealth. Life insurance is not ideal for that. Now, if the life insurance companies out there are probably screaming, no, no, no. But in my opinion, you know, term insurance is going to be the insurance, the primary vehicle for life insurance. And then the permanent policies, advanced estate planning cases, liquidity for estate tax, that's where we would find those policies now.
Okay. We spent a good amount of time here on life insurance, but somebody, again, young, middle age, if you will, there's disability insurance. Let's do disability insurance because nobody pays attention. Excuse me. Very few people pay attention to that, at least in my world.
Well, from the federal perspective, which is really what we're about, you've got disability retirement. And all it takes to qualify for disability retirement is you can't perform useful and efficient service in your current job. Now they're supposed to look to see if there's another job at the same grade and step you are, but normally they don't find one. And then if OPM looks at your medical records and says, okay, you're disabled. Now, it can, depending on how many years of service you have under the old system, CERS, gets you at least 40% of your high three. You can say, well, that's not very much. But strangely enough, they allow you, if you can find work, if you can do other work, you can go out and make up to 80% of your former salary, indexed to inflation, by the way, and still keep your disability benefits in full. And the same is true for FERS. FERS is the first year you get 60% of your high 3 year, second year and years be all after that, you get dropped to, again, 40% of your high 3 when, and then at 62 under FERS, they recompute it as if you actually worked until 62. So it's not, in both cases, CERS and FERS, it's not a bad benefit. But a lot of people say, well, I can't live on that. And particularly if they're younger, you know, even, you know, well, you know, the second year, it's going to be 40% of my high 3 until I, all the way till I'm 62 and I can't live on that. Well, then maybe, you know, you could, I guess, supplement with a private disability.
I have a question, and maybe I should know this answer, but is that disability retirement taxable?
Oh, yes. Okay. Yes.
Well, it is taxable. Yes and no.
Yes and no.
Okay.
There may be some states.
An employee, no. Because you can't do it. But if you had a small business and you wanted your small, again, you're an employee.
I was speaking strictly to the federal.
Okay, but some of them have side businesses, and some of them go into business after they retire, or they might go into business mid-career. And, I mean, I'm out on the limb here, or out on the edge, but it's kind of a slick move if you do it. The policy, if purchased in the company's name, if the premium is paid by the company, it got a tax benefit. So, unfortunately, when the benefit kicks in, then it becomes taxable. If one wanted to be very aggressive, they wait until after the end of the year before they file their tax return, of course, and either they deduct it or they don't. If they became disabled in the prior year, they don't take a deduction in that year. You follow me?
I follow you.
Was the question about disability retirement?
Disability retirement.
Yeah, it's
fully taxable
income. I don't know about disability
I thought
insurance.
We were talking about disability income, sorry.
Yeah.
Disability insurance, if it's, in my case, you know, through my employer, the insurance premium is actually taxed and then it's paid for with after-tax dollars. Yeah. So that's all of the income. So if it's a, you know, 80% payout, then it's 80%.
So we've done life insurance, disability insurance.
Well, I think John's question still with the disability is you can seek out as a federal employee short-term disability, long-term disability, private policies. Short-term disability, there's several of those companies out there, but fairly inexpensive. When you get into long-term disability, very expensive, and to the tune of thousands of dollars a year in premium. Financial underwriting, there's health screening, and to get into one of those policies would pay out, income to you if you were in the ones I like are own occupation descriptions. So if you cannot do your occupation, they're not going to force you to retrain to do something else. So, to go from financial planner to, restaurateur, I mean, they're not going to train me into a different line of work. They're simply going to pay me. Because I can't do my line of work. And you get that with surgeons, you get a lot of doctors, but it's very expensive insurance coverage. So when I get that question in class, I said, you can look into, personal disability insurance, but it's going to be very expensive.
Okay, let's look into the first call. What can we do for you today?
Quick question. Could you bring into the conversation the matter of umbrella insurance coverage and what would be an appropriate level of coverage, say, in relationship to a family's net assets after they get through doing their balance sheet?
Okay, that's good. Actually, you were headed that way, but you got us there quicker, so thanks. So, umbrella insurance, John, it's coverage for potential liability because of?
Lawsuit protection.
Okay.
That's we can kind of call it what it is. It's a separate policy from homeowners or fire coverage. It's a separate policy from your auto policy. It's policy number three. It's coverage everyone should have, and particularly in an area where you're heavy traffic. The heavier the traffic, the more you drive, there's more of an opportunity for you to become involved in an accident. Accidents are accidents. And, someone could come to your house, you're having it's the barbecue time, it could be something as simple as they burn themselves in your grill, they hurt themselves in your pool, you have what they call an attractive nuisance, trampoline, swimming pool. You want to make sure that you have coverage, because they could be the best friend in the world or even family. Bottom line is, once they're hurt and, if they're underinsured medically, it can become your problem in a hurry. But as far as the question of assets, those umbrella policies, generally speaking, because I don't sell that type of insurance, but I guide folks to it all the time, it's about $10 per person. So if you're married, $20 for the couple per month for an extra $1 million in coverage from an umbrella policy. And the question becomes, well, gee, should I have $1 million? Should I have $2 million, $3 million? I think three, maybe $4 million is the upper cutoff for standard umbrella.
I like the higher number because I don't know what's going to happen and and it depends on what state you live in, too, what the damage award would be. Some states are a lot more liberal than others, especially around here. So the point being is, gee, I want enough coverage so it won't hamper my net worth, as the caller mentioned. I got to look at my net worth, and I certainly don't want to spend it on an accident.
Yeah.
So when you hear that kind of number, $3 million, $4 million, $2 million, it just sounds like an awful lot. But with lawsuits, I'm not so sure that it is a lot.
Well, my favorite thing, the price is inexpensive. I mean, it's I'm covering right now actually two primaries. That has to do with the divorce, but two rental homes and two vehicles with $2 million in coverage, and it's I just got the renewal. It's $340 for the year. That is inexpensive. Should I become involved in an accident, it's my fault.
And that covers the rental properties as well?
Rental properties as well.
Wow.
Which, I mean, and where's the liability there? Well, it could be a crack in the concrete.
Everywhere.
The gutter falls off and conks somebody in the head, coming in and out of the house. It could be any number of things. But I don't think that you can be without it. I have a colleague who was, he was actually run over by a vehicle back in December and walking his mother's dog. And so that's my example for class now. And, of course, his name is Mark, and he said that I could freely share that story. But, I feel for the person that ran him over. He was in a crosswalk. The person drove through a stop sign and just swore over top of him. Dog got away. I just want to make sure that everybody.
That's good.
Well, the mother, he didn't sue his mother because he had to walk the dog.
No.
Okay.
So anyways,
that's not so far-fetched. But
so he's, as I said to him, I said, I'm sure that's not the time when you want to be thinking about, on the way to the hospital, what your own coverage is. And, I feel for the person that ran him down, but I'm sure that she probably, like most folks, had to go home in a state of panic and open up the auto policy for the first time, because when she got it, she knew she just had paid the bill and, she didn't even threw it in the drawer or the file cabinet and forgot about it. And that's not the time you want to open your policy to find out, hey, how much am I covered for? And I teach this in class, and a lot of folks, when they come up, they've got the ghostly look, and they're like, I've only got $75,000, $150,000 on my auto policy for limits of liability. Is that enough? And I go, that's $75,000 per person, $150,000 max per accident. So I said, if you were to severely injure someone and, the helicopter flies in and they're legitimately injured, I mean, it's a bad accident. That $75,000 is going to go fast. And the problem I believe you would have there is that the insurance company wouldn't even bother to send the attorneys out because that coverage at $75,000 is minimal. And then how does the judgment go? I don't know, but I rarely ever hear of anyone getting sued for a low amount. It's usually in the millions. So, you know, then everything that you own pretty much is up for grabs. Of course, things like TSP are protected, 401ks, your home, but everything else is up for grabs. And then the bad thing would be that if there's not enough to cover the settlement, if you don't have the ability to pay, you know, outside of what your insurance company paid, they're garnishing your paycheck. And I was teaching a group up at, in the Washington area, and young engineers, 30 of them in a room, and none of them had the coverage. And one of them said, well, you know, we're young. Why would we need that? We don't have anything for them to take. And I said, well, yeah, you have your income that they could take over the rest of your career. And every one of them, I believe, went out and bought an umbrella policy.
All right. So did that answer the question?
Yeah, I was also thinking in terms of frequency of review of appropriate level of coverage, given the fact that if you're somebody who happens to be fortunate enough to have a fair amount of net investable assets in the market and so forth, and with the rise in market valuations, your balance sheet is also rising as well, might necessitate a more frequent review of appropriate level of coverage than you might otherwise think because of the market escalation in prices.
Great point. The bottom line is, like you said, the bottom line, the net worth, and if it's increasing and your coverage is X and the value is Y being higher, you might want to bump it up. Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. And I would say that, the best person to talk to that about would be your family attorney. Make them aware of your balance sheet, and you know, with their experience of litigating cases, or there's going to be hopefully somebody in their practice, or you know, that they can have some good insight for your area as to if someone was in court and they were at fault, what type of judgments do they see happening, and you may want to do that, talk to your insurer, see what the upper limit is on that type of policy, but.
Personally, my wife and I do have the coverage, but what we have been tracking more closely, in essence, has been the valuation appreciations of what we own. And we constantly, almost on a yearly basis, ask ourselves, do we think that we have an adequate level of coverage as it relates to the umbrella policy?
Good.
Yeah, and I would say that it's my understanding of the court process in cases like that is that accidents are accidents, and it's not a lottery win for the person that's injured. It's simply to get them reestablished to the point they were as close as they can be prior to the accident. But very rarely do you hear of cases where folks are being put in the poorhouse because of an accident, especially if they have proper coverage. So I believe there's probably some upper limit to an award that would be awarded. They're not going to strip everything away from you if you have several million dollars in coverage.
Mm-hmm. And especially given the litigious nature of our society as a whole nowadays, it perhaps argues to err on the side of caution.
Especially around here.
Yep.
Depends on what state you live in.
Exactly. As I teach that topic, I just mentioned to folks, just look at the number of billboards on the way to work, listen to the radio shows, listen to the advertising. If you happen to be at home sick, watching daytime TV, that's all you see is ad after ad after ad. If you've been injured, I mean, there's a lot of those ads, and it's just because we live in an area where you have a lot of folks. It's a high density area in any city across the country. So,
all righty.
Okay, I appreciate the time. Thank you very much.
Thanks for the questions.
You. Certainly.
Long-term care. When should somebody look at it? What is it? Is there a way to maneuver the premiums? Let's start with the basics. When should somebody start to think about it?
I always say post 50, 50 and over.
So, in other words, if somebody got it younger, the premium is less, but they're paying it for a longer period of time.
Yes.
And you get into your world, future value and present value of cash flows. And,
well, It's more of a deteriorating health condition post 50, and I you know, that's why I've got the watch on for walking and counting my steps, and I got my 5 miles in this morning. So, but you know, post 50, I'm at the point. Well, I'm 46, be 47, in November, and you know, it's something that you definitely want to look at. And the reason I'm actually even in advance of 50, maybe for some folks, is that those policies, there's major carriers that have dropped out of that coverage. They don't offer it anymore. The policies that were issued by folks that bought in 10 years ago, they've been paying into them, but they're now grandfathered in with some really phenomenal benefits that are no longer available. So one thing that I can tell you is long-term care insurance is evolving, and I should say devolving. It used to cover a heck of a lot more than the new policies do today. So there is a grandfathering effect, luckily, for folks that got into those policies when they first became available. But I think that's what you'll continue to see. You'll see the prices continue to escalate, and you'll see features and benefits that are offered today stripped out of policies in the future. And long-term care is kind of a misnomer anyways. In my opinion, it should have been termed asset protection insurance, because that's really what we're after with long-term care is folks have assets. And, in my experience is, I have folks that I've worked with over the years. I mean, in this area, pretty typical across the country. I mean, your big two conditions, Alzheimer's, dementia, you're looking at $8,000 to $9,000 a month. And that's in today's dollars. And with your baby boom population aging, we got 10,000 a day turning 65. It's an 18-year process. With their demand on the health system, long-term care is only going to get more expensive. So an inflation factor for long-term care, conservatively, I'd say, is 5%. And I would suspect it may even be higher than that with this, increased demand on the healthcare system. But if you can just envision, in this case, Bob and his lovely wife, Nancy, Bob comes down with a condition. I always get to pick on the guys. He has Alzheimer's.
It's probably accurate.
Yeah. Bob can't remember my name, down the road. And, Nancy's dealing with a condition. The problem that you have, Nancy would have, is that, at least in the state of Maryland, she could be in a spend down. Hopefully Bob is a CPA, has done a good job saving. But hypothetically, if it was $8,000 to $9,000 a month, Nancy could suddenly be in a position where, she's evaporated the money from savings, CDs, retirement accounts. And what happens is she would have to spend herself down to around roughly $110,000 before Bob would qualify for Medicaid, which is insurance for the poor. And that's not really, as we would say, good planning. And so when we talk about long-term care, I talk about protecting one's assets. It's not necessarily being in, a five-star deluxe, room at the nursing home. It's so that you don't impoverish your spouse, or you're not burning your assets up. You're using, leveraged dollars. The premium payments may seem significant, but when you look at the total benefit that could be pulled from the policy, should you need to go into a nursing facility or you need someone to come to your house, home care, it gets expensive in a hurry.
As I understand it, with long-term care, it's somewhat parallel to disability in that they're not the same, clearly, in that if you have a wait period before you can ask for the payment of coverage, if it's a 30-day wait or a 60-day wait, the premium is going to be higher because the payments would be paid earlier. But if you wait for 6 months, or I don't know if there's an outside 6 months,
usually
9 months.
90 days is typical. Yeah. for a wait. There are some carriers out there that have a zero wait for home care. Again, a lot of those benefits, the bells and whistles between carriers are disappearing just because as they have claims coming in against those policies now that folks have become older. They're now on the claim side of it saying, hey, we're going to have problems supporting this if, we have a lot more folks getting that care. So one thing about long-term care folks should, I think, realize from the start, too, is that your premium is not fixed for life. And as there's a the pool of insured as folks need the care, as benefit is paid out, of course, those folks then most likely will quit paying in because they're being taken care of, the premium stop. What's happening, or what folks are seeing, is that they're seeing premium increases. And I think they're going to get worse, those premium increases, before they get better. So going into the long-term care purchase, you have to know that the premium that you're quoted to begin with is only going to increase over your lifetime, not decrease. But again, I had someone in class a couple months back, and he said, well, geez, I did the math that, you know, I figured out by the time I get my dad's age, and apparently his dad had a cognitive issue, that he would have paid in about $30,000 to $35,000 in premium. And he goes, but on the other side, I'll have a policy when I'm that age that will have a benefit to pay for my care of roughly $650,000. And I said, now you're thinking on the right path. And that's the way you have to think about this insurance coverage. There's also partnership coverage, which a lot of states are now partnership states, where they will actually let you keep a mirror image of what was paid out by the insurance company. So if your policy depletes itself, so you had $650,000 and spent every penny of it. In the case of Bob, Bob's wife gets to keep $650,000 above the spend down limit, and then Bob would qualify for Medicaid. So states are making it much more attractive for folks to purchase long-term care. And I think one thing Bob will confirm is the state of Maryland has a $500 tax credit, which is not a deduction. It's where you actually get money back.
Yeah.
And it's amazing to me how many folks, when I ask that question in class, don't know about it. And they go, you know, as I like to tell folks, when you hear that news, I mean, especially if you're married, that's a $1,000 bill back in your wallet. And all you have to do is claim it on your tax return. And Maryland is going so far as, I know the legislature has a reformer coming up here soon, that they want to extend that $500 tax credit per person every year.
I was going to say, in Maryland, it's a one-time shot in your first year. And if you miss it, you got to go back and amend. Or if it's beyond the statute, you don't get it. But whereas Virginia has a tax deduction, not like John said, a credit is a dollar for dollar reduction of your tax, but in Virginia there's a tax deduction each year,
which is fantastic.
Yeah.
And the way it works is the federal government funds Medicaid. They give the money to the states, but the states have to administer, and if there's a shortfall, the states have to make up the difference. So the states are getting very very aggressive about tax deductions, tax credits, encouraging folks to buy long-term care because, they have the statistics. They know what it's going to cost down the road for, their constituents to be taken care of. So I think it should be on everyone's radar. And in fact, the timeline for federal employees, the transition at age 50 should be, what life insurance do I need into my retirement years? And then a transition over into long-term care insurance as well. And a lot of times what we're doing for folks is that they're at that age 50. The kids hopefully are, close to gone or, out of college, or maybe they're still in college. But the life insurance need starts to drop off, and some of those premium dollars that are being paid towards life insurance could be then shifted to long-term care insurance. Folks will have dead assets. There's still a tremendous amount of money sitting in money markets, CDs, and another strategy that we'll employ is we'll take some of those dead assets, get them invested appropriately, risk tolerance, taken into account, and then use the return from that asset. Back in the old days, you could say put some money in tax-free bonds, get a tax-free income from the tax-free bonds, and use the income from those bonds to pay the premium on the long-term care. So it makes a really nice, tidy package. The person still has their asset. That asset's now paying for the long-term care coverage. So a lot of different ways to be creative to pay for the insurance, but it's an absolute must for anyone that has, significant assets. Or, if the assets are below $1 million, I'd say yes. There are certain cut lines where if someone doesn't have enough assets, we would encourage them not to get the coverage, and just because they would fall right to Medicaid. So,
did you just because you mentioned tax-free bonds? There was a DC general obligation offering last week. Mm-hmm. It was called a century bond. It's due in 100 years. Oversold. That people couldn't buy it fast enough.
Really?
And now I'm sure the rates are stratified, you know, short-term, long-term. But I think the long-term rate, of course, it's 100 years, is 4 7/8 or something. I couldn't believe, I don't think I've ever heard of a century bond.
That's a new one for me as well.
Yeah. Maybe this is the only one, but.
Well, therein lies the problem too. And I, you know, it's, I know folks have a, that, you know, there's a lot of folks out there that have a fairly low risk tolerance and they're big fans of bonds. But, you know, if I get you a 24-year bond, Bob, today, that's paying 10%, you'd be all over it. Yeah, but the problem with that is that bond offers no growth. It's going to give you a high level of income for 24 years. And say you put $100,000 into that type of bond, a 24-year bond, 10%. I mean, who wouldn't jump at that in today's low-interest environment? The bigger problem you have is that 24 years from now, you get your $100,000 back, and it only spends like $50,000 today. So fixed income is exactly that. Fixed income, there has to be growth. There has to be you know, some level of stock or equity or something that's going to give growth built into to folks' portfolios. And that's a whole different topic. But
Of course, if you bought a 10% bond, you'd pay a lot more than the face, right? And isn't that the way it works?
Well, no, I mean, say they were issuing 10% bonds now. But no, it's just hypothetically, I mean, folks would want that all day long. But that's interesting. Century bond, I haven't heard that one.
Nor had I.
No. I wouldn't have been the first one to jump on that one. No. And that's interesting.
All righty. We do this show. We're talking about insurances today. We talk about other things other days. But sometimes I'm sure the listeners, as well as the folks in class, are just scratching their head. I got these insurances that I should be covering. I got healthcare premiums I have to watch out for. Automobile insurance. You know, if I put them in pecking order, let's not do that. But what could I do? This is really probably not a fair question to ask you. What could I do with out if I have to cover myself for a lot of other things, auto, homeowners, life insurance, etc.? Or do I just back off some of the coverage? Let's take liability insurance, mm-hmm. For example. Do I take X dollars? Maybe it's not what I should, but I just can't afford anything else. But as you mentioned, the premium is so inexpensive.
Yeah, $10 a month. And you know, something that we left out of that conversation is that policy also covers your legal defense. Any major carrier, say you had $500,000 on your auto policy, plus stacked on top of that another $1 million in umbrella liability, you can believe that the insurance company is going to send representation out. They're going to pay for your attorney that's part of the package, but they're going to send their own attorneys who are schooled in those cases, and that's what they do every, you know, working day of the year for the insurance companies. So I can't overstress the need for umbrella liability insurance. And it just shocks me that when I run into folks, it was never brought up to them by their property casualty agent. So that's one that I say you cannot do without. That's
agreed.
Right. Everyone should have that. It's, you're going to have to, where you trim is, I mean, the life insurance, you don't buy the permanent policy. You get the term policies, and term policies, they have them out there. I've seen them as far as 40 years. 30 years is pretty typical. But I did find out, because I had that question myself, is, you know, what's the latest age someone could get a 30-year term policy? And the answer that I was given was it's right around 54, 55. And if you think about that, I mean, you buy a 30-year term policy and you're 54, I mean, if you qualify for it from a health situation, it's going to carry you till you're 84.
Till you're almost there.
So, and then my question is, why do you need a ton of insurance, life insurance, when you're 84? I would hope that, you know, you got your financial house in order by the time you're 84. But yeah, I mean, that's why 50, when we're looking at a timeline for federal folks, anyone in private industry, they need to make that transition. How much life insurance, get the inexpensive term. And something that a lot of folks aren't aware of is if you get a term policy, you have select preferred, which would be the best, preferred, which is still better than standard. You know, I have this lingering cholesterol issue, blood pressure issue. So my policy is standard. Luckily, I didn't get rated. But if I, you know, through walking and in you know getting in shape, I'm able to lower my cholesterol, lower my blood pressure, get off meds for that, I can actually reapply to the insurance company, and they will lower my premium down. So if I can qualify as preferred, select preferred, I can actually go back to the carrier. Generally, you have to wait 1 year, and I can have them reduce the premium. And I had a gentleman in, and I mean, I love doing that for folks, but he was a smoker. He had a smoker policy. And I said, when's the last time you smoked? He said, 7 years ago. And I said, let me call the insurance company. We had him send a form over. He retested, and it literally saved him around $100 a month in premium. So significant savings.
Okay, we're running out of road here. And what a great analytical view of these different things. Thank you, John.
You're welcome, Bob.
And real life experiences from the other John.
You're welcome.
How did somebody get in touch with you? I messed up and didn't ask that, but do it fast.
301-704-0544. Or trader John, letter J, at juno.com.
Great. And we're next week, and we have some ladies from NARF who've retired, and they're going to share their experiences with Tammy and Mike, and it should be a good show. Thanks for listening, and talk to you all next week. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to For Your Benefit, presented by NITP. Please tune in next Monday at 10 a.m. for a topic solely devoted to you, the federal employee. The show can also be heard 24/7 on federalnewsradio.com. Thanks for listening.